Tonight's reading is from the Gospel of John, chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with us? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." Now there were 6 stone water pots set there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 or 30 gallons each. Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." So they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw some out now and take it to the head waiter." So they took it to him. When the head waiter tasted the water, which had become wine, and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the head waiter called the bridegroom and said to him, "Every man serves the good wine first, and when the people have drunk freely, then he serves the poorer wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum, he and his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there a few days. The word of the Lord.
So, we made it past the darkest day of the year, and we're alive. I mean, I don't know how you're really feeling deep inside, but I can tell that you're breathing, and that's not nothing. You're alive! The light is inching its way against the darkness. People used to die in the depth of winter. I mean, die when the food supplies ran out, or the wood had all been burned, starve, or freeze to death. Maybe just breathing is enough reason to celebrate. This is the third day of the season of Epiphany, when the church celebrates the light of Jesus coming into the world. But if that seems like an abstract sort of concept, celebrating the life of Jesus coming into the world, just celebrating the light, I think will do. And you know what? Your body is actually doing that for you. You might not even be conscious of it, but your neurotransmitters are starting to deliver more serotonin to your brain. Your body is lapping up the light. Grace is being performed. Try and sense it. I really love that the Christian liturgical calendar is tied to the rhythms of the planet, the amount of light in our days. Christmas comes right after the darkest day of the year. Epiphany comes when you can just sort of start to tell that the light really is starting to return. Lent comes when, even though the light's returning, it seems like the winter's going to last forever. And then Easter Sunday follows the first full moon after the spring equinox. I can hardly wait. Imagine green grass, temperatures above 10 degrees. It's not like I have to pretend that I'll be excited, as if it was some sort of religious duty to anticipate Easter. Celebrating the light returning, it's like a very universal thing. Every culture, every religion, everywhere, all the time, people have celebrated it. They light bonfires, they dance, they read poetry all night, they fast, pray, they wear elaborate masks and elaborate ceremonies. In Japan, apparently, people take long, warm baths scented with a citrus fruit. To be honest, I wish I was doing that right now instead of being up here preaching. The church placed the Feast of Epiphany on a date that coincided with the festival of the Egyptian goddess Isis, which included all manner of revelry, some drunkenness, some other stuff. The story about Jesus turning water into wine fits with the season. I like to imagine how the grace of God might at times be like a very, very good wine, offering not something abstract or cerebral, but the greatest possible sensory enjoyment. That seems unlikely, but maybe I underestimate the nature of grace. The author of John makes these enormous claims about Jesus in his first chapter. Full of grace upon grace, truth, the light of every human being. And then suddenly, the life and the light of the entire world through whom everything was made is at a wedding with his mom. Standing around just like everybody else, shifting their weight from one foot to the other, wondering, how fun is this celebration going to actually be? Jesus is about to perform the first act of his public ministry, but it doesn't seem like it's really his idea. He does it because his mom tells him to. It's so beautifully human, I think, and there's something kind of vulnerable about it. I just did a wedding yesterday. And we had another wedding here last week. There were two other weddings in the fall. A wedding may seem like a sort of rarefied experience in your personal life, but people are doing it all the time. It's a common occurrence. I'm always struck about how weddings are so full of so many things. Hope and failure, till death do us part. Beauty, flowers, food, family dynamics, worries, fears of all varieties. After the rehearsal on Friday evening, I asked if anyone had any questions or concerns about how the ceremony was going to go, and the father of the groom said he was concerned about the cracks in the floor. I didn't know what to read into that one. Or maybe there was nothing to read into it. It was an old warehouse space, so maybe it was a legitimate concern. But I can only imagine, as a parent at your child's wedding, how much you must feel. What complex concerns. What a mix. There's wedding imagery all over the Bible. In Isaiah, the land is married to God, who delights in her like a young man who marries a virgin. It's a pretty racy metaphor, honestly. God is married to the land and delights in it, not like an old married couple delights in each other, but like the first blush of some erotic joy. The scripture is so weird and so interesting. When some of the writers imagine the most passionate hope for what is to come, the great eschatological hope beyond time at the end of ordinary reality, they imagine enormous amounts of good wine. It seems so grounded and so sensual. Amos says the mountains shall drip with sweet wine, and the hills shall flow with it. Isaiah imagines the consummation of God's kingdom as God making a feast of delicious food for all people, a feast of well-aged wines. That seems like a grace that you could feel, taste, something that would satisfy you, not just abstractly. So Jesus and his mom are at this wedding, and almost immediately Jesus' mom notices they have no wine. It seems like a pronouncement of doom and gloom and darkness and winter and joyless hopelessness. And it was not just an enormous social disgrace, but a bad sign for the couple. This is actually the first glimpse we get in John of Jesus' mother. The first words she utters, they have no wine. It's almost like a lament. The only other time we encounter her in John's book is at the foot of the cross when her son dies. It's like she's this figure who appears at these archetypal moments of human anxiety, death, and the moment that the wine runs out. Some Protestant interpreters, put off by Romanist reverence of Mary, use this passage as evidence that Mary isn't really worthy of veneration. Like, she was too concerned with ordinary things. Geez, you know, Hail Mary, full of grace, if you ask me, don't we need help with ordinary things? She doesn't exactly come across here like the kitschy statues and paintings imagine her, the whole subservient, quiet, handmaiden thing. It's just a brief scene, obviously, but I wouldn't say from this glimpse that she really seems to worship her son, though I'm sure she loves him like crazy. She thinks he should make himself useful, help these people in this real moment in their real lives. I mean, if he can't really help anyone, what would be the point? Grandeur, greatness, who really cares? What good does that do? Maybe she's hoping he'll forgo that whole male ego thing and be the kind of man that is just happy to help in the kitchen. I like her here. I think maybe Jesus doesn't come off all that great here. Most commentaries I read insist that Jesus' reply to his mother is not impatient or disrespectful. I don't know, maybe, woman, what do you have to do with me? Is code for thank you for giving birth to me and feeding me from your own body. That doesn't really sound like it to me. Maybe there's a better translation. But one way or the other, it seems like his agenda or whatever, his purpose is more important than what's happening in the life of this family. But his mother seems prescient, grounded, wise. She seems to disregard her son's dismissal, like she isn't quite listening to him. Like maybe she knows something. However aloof and unresponsive and reluctant to disrupt his plans Jesus may seem, really his mother trusts him to begin his ministry here. And this first sign of palpable grace is important. She trusts him to do something about the situation, this archetypal anxiety. There's not enough wine or light or warmth or love, not enough to cover what the world needs, which is vast. And even though Jesus says it's not his time, he seems to take directions from his mom to address the situation. The life and light of the world looks around and locates these containers that hold water, the water that the guests use to wash their hands. And he fills them with amazing wine. He fills the containers meant to hold the water people use to clean up before dinner with wine. It seems pretty exciting, but it also seems a little bit impolite. Like, how are the people going to wash their hands? It's really a little bit of a funny miracle, I think. Washing hands is the polite thing. You need water for it, and Jesus turns the water into really, really good wine. I mean, are people grateful? Or are they a little bit like, what the hell? It's like a really beautiful move, and it's really like messing with things. It seems like a good combination to me. We have all sorts of rituals that are important to us, to our religious practice, or just how we think one should properly conduct themselves in the world, stop at stop signs, stand in lines, cough into your elbows, wash your hands, put your money in a bank, even if it is a Wall Street monstrosity. We have rules that seem important for people to obey. Jesus fills the containers of water necessary for people to obey the rules with wine. It's not like he exactly blows them up, but he fills them with something delightful. I'm not sure how we might apply this sort of spirit to civil disobedience, but I think it would be a good thing to contemplate. People are sometimes worried about reading this as if Jesus might be offending the religious people here. It's not about offense, they say. It's about generosity, excessive abundance. But maybe that is occasionally offensive to people who are concerned about following the rules. Excess can be offensive. Excessive lying, for sure. To what sort of anarchy might that lead? Jesus is doing a miracle for their wedding party. He makes sure there's enough, way more than enough. But I wonder how the parents of the bride felt. I wouldn't be surprised if their reaction was a little bit mixed. Something bursts out of the bounds of the expected, interferes with proper decorum. It's amazing wine, but it interferes with people's ability to follow the rules. What if you couldn't put your money in a bank, invest in the stock market, buy insurance? What if Facebook crashed and all the cell phone towers were filled with wine instead of whatever they're filled with? I read about a city in the Netherlands where they got rid of all the traffic signals, even the stop signs, and there were far fewer accidents. Maybe some people didn't even want to drink the good wine because it seemed to interfere with the rules. But maybe, I don't know, but maybe that's a little bit what grace is like sometimes. Like, say someone lives under the reign of an oppressive regime, for example. And instead of following the rules, they follow love. I think maybe grace and love can lead to some upsetting things, like it upsets things. I think there's a sense in which the sheer excess of the life and love of God could be a little traumatic for us. So maybe we don't always choose to drink it. Jesus keeps coming off in this sort of wild way throughout the book of John, a little too much something, too much for the dominant ideology to bear. Talking to the Samaritan woman, he isn't supposed to even talk to a woman, much less a foreigner, much less ask for a drink from her jar, and then talking about a water that he can provide that flows unstoppably, unquenching every thirst. Maybe he's not being flirtatious. But he is not being polite. In John, Jesus says, "Eat my body and drink my blood." What a strange guy. But what is it like to be full of grace upon grace, truth, and love? Maybe the good wine is always there for the drinking, but we're a little bit afraid of where drinking it might lead. Loving your neighbor as yourself, loving your enemy, serving God instead of mammon. I don't think there's much question that that messes with the order. Jesus comes around acting like this. No wonder the religious authorities wanted to kill him. He seems genuinely dangerous to the system, organization, institutions. I mean, really. The story is about a collision between the ministry of Jesus and the conventional order. The conventions we follow, submit to, maybe without even really meaning to. It's economic necessity. It's a public school system conceived to make good workers of our children, not call into question the systems of oppression. We live subservient to these systems, though they are racist, though they favor the rich, though they threaten the life of the planet. Like living any other way seems impossible. Without profit-making corporations, cell phones, fossil fuels, it doesn't seem realistic. Like changing water into wine. This passage is read in the traditional wedding liturgy to bless a couple getting married. As you gladden the wedding in Cana of Galilee by the presence of your son, so by his presence now bring your joy to this wedding. It's really kind of a bold prayer. His joy? Well, what is that going to be like? It's practically like inviting this anarchic spirit into the solemn occasion. I mean, watch out. It's like unleashing the God of excessive life and love and grace, infinite boundary-breaking, undefinable, uncontainable, unleashing the human institution-crashing God into your little ceremony, your little ritual. I think that's what we do here with our little ritual. We drink the wine, the excessive love, and it may be a little traumatic to drink the death of death and thus the sheer excess of life. So maybe that's why we drink just a little.